Welcome, and thank you for standing by. All lines will be on listen-only until the question-and-answer session of today's conference. At that time, to ask a question, please press star one on your touch-tone phone. Again, that's star one to ask a question. This call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would like to now introduce Mr. Tom Skinner. Sir, you may begin.
Thank you, Jennifer, and thank you all for joining us today for this update on the U.S. response to Ebola. We'll be going over some interim guidance that the CDC is releasing today for the monitoring and movement of persons with potential Ebola virus exposure. With us today is the director of the CDC, Dr. Tom Frieden, who will provide some opening remarks, and then we will get to your questions. Dr. Frieden.
Good afternoon, everyone, and thanks very much for joining us. Today, CDC is releasing new guidelines that use our experience to increase the protection of the health and safety of Americans, which is our first priority. Healthcare workers doing heroic work protecting the U.S. in West African countries, which are heavily affected, may return to this country, and these guidelines outline what can be done to protect them and to protect our communities. They rely on individualized assessment. They rely on the experience that we've had over the past month. Today marks exactly 1 month since the first case of Ebola diagnosed in the U.S. or anywhere in this hemisphere. Mr. Duncan was diagnosed on September 28th. Since his diagnosis, three more individuals have been diagnosed with Ebola in the United States. This is unprecedented. Managing Ebola is not easy, and what we're doing with these new guidelines is using experience and data to refine the policies and programs that we recommend. At CDC, we base our decisions on science and experience. We base our decisions on what we know and what we learn. And as the science and experience changes, we adopt and adapt our guidelines and recommendations. I'd like to recap a couple of things. First, about the disease, and second, about what we're doing to stop it. Ebola only spreads from people who have symptoms of the disease, and it only spreads through direct contact with someone who's sick or their body fluids. The highest risks are in people who are providing caregiving, especially for patients as they become increasingly sick. And in West Africa, where burial practices are different, burial can also be a source of transmission. It's worth remembering some of the classic studies done of Ebola over past years, including a study done by CDC authors that systematically monitored all 173 household members of 27 patients with Ebola. Of the household members, overall, 16% developed Ebola. But of the 78 household members who had no direct contact with patients with Ebola, despite living in the same house or hut in Africa, despite sharing meals and being in the same household, zero became ill with Ebola. That doesn't mean there's zero risk to contacts, but it does mean that Ebola spreads primarily by contact with the body fluids or body of someone who is sick with Ebola. I'd also like to recap the different levels of protection that CDC and our partners throughout the U.S. government and globally are implementing. First and foremost is working to stop Ebola at the source in Africa. CDC today has more than 160 staff in the field helping to lead, guide, and support all aspects of the response. We work very closely with our partners throughout the U.S. government, USAID, the Department of Defense, the State Department, as well as our global partners. In addition, since summer, we've been doing exit screening on all people leaving West Africa, identifying those with fever and removing them before they board the aircraft. Beginning on October 11th at JFK and then October 16th at the other four airports, we've been screening all entrants for fever and for exposure to Ebola. Starting a week ago Saturday, we began providing to all entrants care kits, check and report Ebola. These kits consist of a thermometer, health education materials, information about how to contact the local health department or healthcare providers, a card to show if they become ill and seek care. And since beginning the entry screening to the U.S., We've also been providing information on the names, addresses, and other contact information of all travelers returning to state health departments so that they can monitor the care and the progress of people who are going through their 21-day incubation period. CDC has also worked with health departments throughout the country to expand the laboratory response network so individuals who are suspected of having Ebola can be rapidly tested and that can be assessed. We've sent rapid Ebola preparedness teams to hospitals around the country so that they can be better prepared in the event of someone with suspected Ebola. We've established an Ebola response team anytime there's a highly suspected or confirmed Ebola case. That team is at Bellevue today, working side by side with the excellent clinicians and hospital infection control staff of that hospital to improve the safety and improve the care of that individual. And we've established protocols for management of individuals in emergency departments who might have Ebola. Through all of this, we expect there to be an increasing number of individuals for whom there is a concern that they might have Ebola. That doesn't mean there are more cases. Until a laboratory test confirms a case, it's not confirmed. But these series of steps add levels of protection to the U.S. Also, starting today, the six states to which 70% of all of the returning travelers return will be doing an active monitoring program to monitor their health on a daily basis so that if they develop symptoms, they can rapidly be assessed and, if they're found to have Ebola, effectively isolated and treated. The new guidelines increase the level of protection by outlining different levels of exposure and outlining different public health actions that can be taken for each of those levels of exposure. We identify four different levels. The first are high-risk exposures, things like a needle stick from someone who's been caring for Ebola patients, or someone who had a known exposure to a patient with Ebola, for example, a family member who cared for someone when they were sick without using protective equipment. The next level is the some risk category. In that category, we include someone who might have been in the household of a patient with Ebola but didn't provide any direct care or have any direct contact, or a healthcare worker returning from Africa where they've been caring for patients with Ebola. We've had about 100 or a little under 100 individuals per day on average returning from the three affected countries in West Africa. Of those, about 5 or 6% have been found to have a background of working in healthcare. Specifically, it's been 46 out of the 807 people who we have evaluated. There's also a low but non-zero risk, such as someone who's been traveling within the affected countries but has had no known exposure. And we would put into that category also a healthcare personnel, doctor, nurse, or other healthcare staff who's been working at a United States facility caring for an individual with Ebola. Bellevue, Emory, NIH, and Nebraska are the facilities that are currently and potentially doing that. For those individuals, they have very important differences between providing care in Africa versus in the U.S. U.S. hospitals have a more controlled setting than a field hospital in Africa, and the staffing ratio is very different. So in that category, we consider them to be of low but non-zero risk. And the fourth category is those who have no identified risk. For example, individuals who did not travel to one of the affected countries or traveled more than 21 days ago. We've received over 500 inquiries from health departments and hospitals and doctors who've been concerned that patients might be at risk for Ebola. In 90% of those inquiries, it turns out that there is not either a symptom pattern or a travel history that's consistent with Ebola. And for the remainder, we've been able to facilitate rapid testing. In terms of the public health actions that can be taken, the first, and I believe most important, is active monitoring. And that means that the health department, the local public health authority, takes the responsibility for a daily monitoring of the individual's symptoms and of their temperature. And if people have symptoms or elevated temperature, they're rapidly assessed, evaluated, and if appropriate, isolated, cared for, and treated. This type of active monitoring is so important because it can identify people early in the course of illness. And we know with Ebola that as people get sicker, they get much more infectious. Those first few hours or days of the beginning of symptoms are far less likely to result in any infections than are the later courses of disease when people have much larger numbers of virus that they're excreting. But in cases where there is a high risk of an individual potentially becoming ill, or based on an individualized assessment of the exposure, of the activity, of the individual, of the circumstance, additional restrictions may be placed. Those may include, on an individualized basis, what's called a do not board order, which would prevent the individual from getting on a flight. At the local level, restrictions on use of public transport, work, or attendance at congregate activities. But fundamentally, people want to do the right thing. And what I'm hearing from returning healthcare workers and others is an interest in making sure that they are cared for effectively and they're responsible so that if they do develop any symptoms, they're rapidly isolated and treated. In fact, Doctors Without Borders, MSF, has had very clear guidelines for their staff that for their own protection, they should stay within a close radius to a facility that can care for them. And this is the kind of approach that we think will be effective. In addition, while I understand there are concerns that individuals may not fully disclose information about their history, I think those concerns about illness are of a very different order. Healthcare workers of all people understand that if they develop Ebola, the sooner they get care, the more likely they are to survive, and the sooner they get isolated, the less likely they are to infect their family members. Overall, there's real progress in different ways in the Ebola response, but we're still far from out of the woods. In Texas, we have seen most of the healthcare workers who cared for Mr. Duncan complete their 21-day observation period. Two nurses became infected, in all likelihood, in the initial days of Mr. Duncan's illness. We have improved our personal protective equipment and infection control guidelines to reduce the risk of infections in the future. In New York City, we continue to monitor closely the illness of Dr. Spencer and the monitoring of his contacts. In Africa, we have now surged, along with the World Health Organization, to respond to the importation of a case into the country of Mali, where contact tracing has identified now more than 100 people who will be tracked and where the largest number are in a rural area, similar to other Ebola outbreaks, but we're far from out of the woods. And in each of the three heavily affected countries in West Africa, we are seeing definite signs of progress, but it's going to be still a long, hard fight, and the assistance of healthcare workers from around the world will be essential to stopping it there and protecting these countries as well as ourselves. I wish we could get to zero risk in the U.S., but we will only get to zero risk by stopping it at the source. While we're trying to do that, we are also implementing a series of measures to reduce the risk in the U.S. The bottom line is we're today releasing new guidelines on the monitoring and movement of people who may have been exposed to the Ebola virus. These guidelines increase the level of protection of the health and safety of Americans, which is our first and foremost concern, while at the same time recognizing the heroic work that's going on in West Africa by these individuals, or some of these individuals, and that's protecting us from the disease. Thank you.
And Jennifer, I believe we're ready for questions, please.
Okay, the first question comes from Miriam at the CNN Medical News. Your line is open.
Hi, Dr. Frieden. So you're saying individualized basis. Some states are saying people coming back who may have been exposed, who we know were exposed, like healthcare workers, need to be quarantined immediately. What are your specific statements on that, and how does that fit into the new guidelines? And then do you know anything about the five-year-old in New York that may or may not have Ebola? And is there a faster way to test for Ebola instead of the PCR testing that takes 6 to 12 hours?
All right. Well, first, the level of monitoring and restriction placed on individuals in our new guidelines depends very much on their particular risk. So for someone with high risk, someone who, for example, had a needle stick while caring for a patient with Ebola, that individual we would certainly want to have on controlled movement, not on any public conveyances, not out in public places, excluded from workplaces except teleworking or if approved by the local health department. That individual has a very different level of risk from someone who's simply been providing care in West Africa. That we consider to be a some-risk experience. And for that experience, the single most important thing is to rapidly identify if they develop symptoms. And we are recommending that that be done by what we're calling direct active monitoring. That means that someone who is accountable to the local health department or state health department observes as their temperature is taken. That person also has a conversation with the individual, both of these things on a daily basis, about how they're feeling, and goes through a detailed list of symptoms to see if they have anything even as vague as fatigue that might be of concern, and reviews with them what their plans are for their activities. So that if they're planning to stay at home, that's one thing. If they're planning to take other activities, there would be an individualized assessment of what makes sense for that individual at that time. And some of the things that could be considered in that assessment are things as varied as what was the nature of exposure, what kind of work was being done, is the person completely symptom-free, are they able to rapidly seek isolation and care if they were to develop symptoms, and at what point they are in their incubation period. We know that from the data in Africa, it appears that more than 90%, maybe even more than 95% of the cases that will occur in the 21-day period will occur in that first 2 weeks, or roughly 14-day period. So that's the nature of an individualized assessment, and that we think is good, sound public health policy. In terms of testing, the PCR test actually only takes about 3 hours. It takes a shorter period of time if it's strongly positive, a longer period of time if it has to be repeated because it's borderline. The challenge is often to get the specimen to the testing laboratory. That's often a longer delay than the actual testing itself. In terms of the young child at Bellevue, we would refer your questions to the hospital there. From the information we've seen, the illness would be quite unusual as a presentation of Ebola.
Next question, Jennifer.
Okay. To ask a question, you may press star 1 on your touch-tone phone, unmute your phone, record your name, and I will introduce you. If you need to withdraw your question, you may press star 2. The next question comes from Richard Besser of ABC News. Your line is open.
Thanks very much, Dr. Frieden. The guidelines that you're announcing would it sounds like, not require that a returning healthcare worker be on mandatory home quarantine, and so they're less stringent than many states. I know CDC doesn't have enforcement authority, but what does this mean then? If a patient then, or if a returning healthcare worker flies into one state, they may be held there. If they fly into another, they may be able to get home and not be under home quarantine. It sounds like we're going to be dealing with a patchwork. How do you get away from so many different things in different parts of the country?
With these guidelines, we're engaging in a series of discussions with state and local governments. We find that state health departments generally do follow CDC guidelines. If they wish to be more stringent than what CDC recommends, that's within their authority in the system of government that we have. But we believe these are based on science. And these add a strong level of protection and a strong level of reassurance that someone who is in the some-risk category, such as a returning healthcare worker, is going to be intensively monitored with their temperature actually measured each day and a careful review of their symptoms. That, plus the information that we're providing to each returning traveler, is, we think, what will be most protective of both the healthcare workers, their families, and their communities. We do have to recognize that if we do things that make it very difficult for people to come back, if we turn them into pariahs instead of the recognizing the heroic work that they're doing, a couple of things may happen that none of us want to happen. They may be less likely to disclose their healthcare worker status, and then we would lose the opportunity to do that direct active monitoring here and to protect them, their families, and their communities. They may be less likely to go help stop it at the source in Africa. And with that, if it spreads further in Africa or longer in the three countries or we can't control it there, the risk to us would increase.
Next question, Jennifer.
Yes, the next question is from Shelby of Bloomberg TV. Your line is open.
Hi, Dr. Frieden. I'm just curious how many people you are actively monitoring right now or are actively being monitored, and also if you have any updates on the 5-year-old boy.
As I said earlier, you'd have to refer to Bellevue for the status of the 5-year-old child, but the pattern of illness, as we've understood it, is not the pattern of illness that we would expect to see in an individual with Ebola. I think the testing will be back in the near future, though, at least the preliminary testing from the CDC Laboratory Response Network laboratory at the New York City Department of Health. In terms of the number of people to be tracked, there are, so far, a little less than 100 people per day entering the U.S. There have been 807 so far, of whom 46 have been identified as healthcare workers or otherwise would be in the some risk category, and that is from the beginning of the program that started at JFK on the 11th of October through the 25th of October.
Next question, please.
The next question comes from Mike of the Associated Press. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you for taking my question. Doctor, I think you might have just clarified one thing. You talked about 100 per day, and I wasn't clear. That was a mix of what, visitors from West Africa, people who live there and were visiting, and also healthcare workers. And also, sir, if you could just go over, I'm sorry, but I found it a little confusing. You outlined four categories: high risk, some risk, low risk, and no risk. But I wasn't clear which new recommendation went with which. Are you recommending at-home voluntary quarantine for high risk, and then for some risk, health departments, active monitor? Could you go over that again?
Sure. Let me first start with the numbers. When we began discussing some of the entry screening, we were using the number of approximately 130 to 150 travelers coming to the U.S. per day. Actual experience has been averaging less than 100 per day since the program started. Most of those individuals are U.S. citizens or legal permanent residents. Of those, let's say less than 100 per day, between 5% and 6% have been returning healthcare workers. Of the four categories of risk, the guidelines, which should now be posted on the CDC site, outline both management of people who are symptomatic and evaluating them for Ebola, and asymptomatic. For the asymptomatic individuals, as you stated, for the high-risk individuals, we are recommending voluntary at-home isolation, including not going on public conveyances, not flying, and doing what's called direct active monitoring, or making sure that someone is observing and discussing with the person each day in terms of their health status and monitoring their temperature. For the some-risk individual, and we consider the healthcare workers returning from West Africa to be in the some-risk category, they would also undergo direct active monitoring. And then the public health authority, based on a specific assessment of that individual situation, would determine whether additional restrictions are appropriate. Those might include not going on planes and buses and trains, being excluded from public places and congregate gatherings, and being excluded from workplaces. Other activities would be assessed as needs and circumstances change, but any travel would need to be coordinated and pre-approved by the public health authorities at both the origin and the destination, with the goal of ensuring that there is uninterrupted direct active monitoring.
Next question, please.
The next question is from Dennis Thompson of Health Day. Your line is open.
Thanks for taking our questions. Just to consider that going down to low risk, would the low risk folks be the people who would be under active monitoring, but by phone, kind of as many of these people are who have been under observation in Texas?
So let me, first off, for the low but non-zero risk, yes, the active monitoring could be by phone. You refer to the Texas outbreak investigation and control activities. This is guidance that refers to both travelers returning to the U.S. and anyone potentially exposed in the U.S. So in the Texas investigation, the healthcare workers who might have been exposed because the infection control procedures which were in place did not prevent two nurses from becoming infected, those individuals would be considered at high risk of infection. In contrast, healthcare workers working, for example, at NIH or Emory caring for Ebola patients are considered at low but non-zero risk. And then contacts of individuals with Ebola are assessed based on their specific level of risk.
Were people held in Dallas, the high-risk folks, were they held in voluntary at-home isolation, or is this something new?
This very much parallels what the experience was in Dallas, that individuals at the highest risk first were asked to ensure that they were actively monitored, and if there was any doubt that they could be actively monitored, then they were asked to stay at home. There were a very small number of people in that category. In New York City, there are three contacts who were in the potentially close contact or high risk. All three of them are being asked to stay at home.
Thanks. Next question, Jennifer.
The next question comes from Ariel Hart of Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Your line is open.
Hi, Dr. Frieden. Two questions. First, our governor is expected to announce Georgia's policy on quarantine and monitoring. Are you aware of it, and do you have any reaction to it? That's expected to come this afternoon. And the second question, given the national or even international implications of quarantine overkill that, like you said, could deter Ebola healthcare workers or deter full disclosure of people's history, not to mention the civil liberty issues involved, what's the reasoning behind leaving it up to states to set their own quarantine policies? Does that make sense?
First off, we look forward to working with Georgia and all other states to get implemented effective science-based policies for people who may have been exposed to Ebola. That's what today's guidelines are about. We've already had very constructive discussions with some of the states, and they've indicated that they will align their policies to our recommendations. And we are willing to work with any of the states to do what is science-based to protect Americans. We are concerned about some policies that we've seen in various places that might have the effect of increasing stigma or creating false impressions. You don't catch Ebola from someone who's not sick. You don't get Ebola from someone unless they're sick and you have direct contact with them or their body fluids. It's not nearly as contagious as the flu, the common cold, measles, or many other infectious diseases. And we have to tailor our approach to the science of Ebola.
Next question, Jennifer.
The next question comes from Rebecca Jacobson of CBS NewsHour. Your line is open.
Hi. Hi. Thanks so much for taking my question. I'm actually with PBS, not CBS. I wanted to ask what is involved with, when you talk about there's the active monitoring and at-home quarantine versus the process, versus the kind of quarantine or isolation that somebody who's been exposed to Ebola might face if they are actually test positive for the disease.
So it's very important to distinguish what's done for someone who may have or is confirmed to have Ebola. For that situation, there is immediate isolation and protection and then tracing of their contact. So anyone who has symptoms of Ebola, until they rule out, they would be isolated in a facility where they can be cared for without risking infection of their caregivers. That's a different set of considerations. To my understanding, what Dr. Spencer did was when he began feeling ill, he arranged for special transport to the facility that was ready to care for Ebola patients. So that's one of the benefits of having the active monitoring program, that you can prearrange with the individuals that if they do become sick, how are they going to seek care?
Next question, Jennifer.
The next question comes from Erica Edwards from NBC News. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you. An editorial published today in the New England Journal of Medicine reads in part, "We now know that fever precedes the contagious stage." I'm just wondering if you can expand on that and explain exactly at what stage a person is contagious.
In all of history, until this outbreak, there were less than 3,000 cases of Ebola. In the current outbreak, there have now been more than 10,000 cases of Ebola, including the first four ever diagnosed in this country. As we learn more about Ebola, we understand how it spreads, we understand how it presents, we understand how to treat it, and we understand what can be done to prevent and control it better. What happens as someone begins to become ill with Ebola is they develop an increase in symptoms. Early on in the course of their disease, tests for Ebola, such as a blood test, may be negative because there is such a tiny quantity of virus in their body. And a negative test is very likely to correlate with that individual not being infectious to others. As people get sicker, they develop fever, and particularly if they develop vomiting or diarrhea later in the course of their illness, there may be large quantities of the virus in their body fluids, and that's where the real risk comes in. It isn't as if someone is going to be completely healthy one moment and the next moment emanating huge quantities of infectious virus. To everything we have seen, it does not happen that way.
Next question, Jennifer.
The next question is from Lena Sun of the Washington Post. Your line is open.
Hi, Dr. Frieden. Thanks for taking these questions. I have two. One is about the numbers. Of those 46 healthcare workers that have been that fall in that category, can you characterize them in any way? Are they being actively monitored? Do they include some of these individuals who've already been mentioned in the numbers? And then the second question is, for those other states who you said are working with you, can you amplify on that a little bit, since several states have already gone out on a limb and announced policies that are more strict than CDC guidelines?
Yes, in fact, you know, this is a program that began, as I mentioned, on the 11th of October at JFK and the other four airports on the 16th of October, so it's relatively recent. Dr. Spencer did go through the screening program, did self-identify as a healthcare worker, did not have a fever there, was assessed. The five-year-old child who's being assessed at Bellevue did go through the screening program, did not have a fever when they entered the country. So the program, the information has been provided to each of the states, and the monitoring is as per the policies of that state. As of now, we have very specific guidance to states, and we're working with them to help them implement that guidance. In terms of the different state policies, I believe that Maryland has issued policies that are quite similar, and we are in active discussions with the other states.
Well, other states is the rest of the, you know, how many are we talking about?
Well, actually, 70% of the returning individuals from the three countries come to six states. Maryland is the second most common. New York is the most. Pennsylvania, Georgia, New Jersey, and Virginia together account for 70% of the individuals who are returning, most of whom, I would remind people, are U.S. citizens or legal permanent residents.
Thank you.
Next question, Jennifer.
The next question comes from Donna Young of Script News. Your line is open.
Thank you, Dr. Frieden. I had a question, first of all, when you went to West Africa on your visit, what guidelines did you follow yourself? And then also, are your guidelines similar to Doctors Without Borders? Or because within their guidelines, they actually advise their healthcare workers to stay home for the 21-day incubation period. So can you kind of explain how maybe the CDC's guidelines differ or are similar with the Doctors Without Borders guidelines? Thank you.
We work closely with Doctors Without Borders. Their guidelines give a general recommendation that is consistent with the guidelines that we're issuing. Our guidelines are directed for state and local public health agencies, but we, along with our colleagues at USAID, have been working very closely with all of the non-governmental organizations that send people to Africa and are looking forward to helping collaborate with state and local health departments to ensure that there's a smooth process for returning to this country. In terms of myself, my 21-day period is long over, and I did not have symptoms during that period. I monitored my symptoms regularly. I didn't have any. If I had, I would have taken appropriate action.
Next question, Jennifer.
The next question is from Robert Lowe's of Medscape.net. Your line is open.
Yes, Dr. Frieden, thanks for taking my call. I guess in terms of the highest risk level of healthcare worker, in terms of just the terminology, you're talking about a voluntary quarantine, right? As opposed to, you know, people have referred to it as isolation, but you're talking about a voluntary at-home quarantine. Is that correct, or
you're talking about for the high-risk individual?
Yes, right. Like with who gets a needle stick, for
right.
instance.
For those individuals, we first are strongly recommending direct active monitoring. So someone is actually monitoring their health and their temperature on a daily basis. We also recommend that the public health authority ensures, through orders if necessary, but voluntary is usually acceptable, that there would be they wouldn't be going on public conveyances, planes, trains, buses. They wouldn't go to public places, shopping centers and movie theaters. They wouldn't go to congregate gatherings or workplaces, although, of course, they could telework. But there are non-congregate activities that could proceed, such as jogging in a park. We would also, for those individuals, implement federal travel restrictions known as the Do Not Board requirement, which prevent people from flying in that circumstance. If people want to travel, that would have to be done by non-commercial conveyance, such as a car. It would have to be coordinated with the public health authority at both the origin and the destination so that there would be uninterrupted direct active monitoring.
So it's Jennifer, we'll take two more questions, please.
Okay, the next question is from Carrie Sheridan of AFP. Your line is open.
Thanks for taking my question. I was wondering if you could clarify for me, were there guidelines from the CDC before on this topic? And if so, how have the current guidelines changed? Is there anything specific you can point to that's changed, or is this the first time the CDC has issued this sort of guideline?
There were prior guidelines. And there are a series of changes. These are more specific. They're more focused. They provide a different risk categorization so that they can provide more useful and clear input to state and local authorities. And they define with a greater level of specificity both the risk levels and the public health actions that will be taken in different situations.
Okay, thanks.
Last question, Jennifer.
Okay, the final question is from Deltia Ricks of Newsday. Your line is open.
Thank you very much, Dr. Frieden. There have been so many problems,
that I'm hearing in the news and interviews that I'm doing of people who think this is extraordinarily contagious on the level of the 1918 flu. You mentioned earlier it's not as contagious as the flu, the common cold, or measles. Can you just go over that again very clearly and very explicitly so I can put it in a story and have these crazy people stop calling me?
Thank you very much. I understand that people are afraid. Ebola is unfamiliar. It is a severe disease, but it is not highly contagious, and it requires direct contact with someone who is sick from Ebola or with their body fluids. I mentioned at the outset of this briefing a classic study done by the CDC in Africa, where people were living together in homes or huts, and of 78 household contacts of patients with confirmed Ebola, many of whom did not get isolated until they had pretty advanced disease, zero who did not have direct contact with the individual became infected. In healthcare, we have a saying, never say never. We are very clear that we're still assessing the situation, and with the outbreak continuing in Africa, it is still possible that people will come to this country and be diagnosed with Ebola. We still have healthcare workers being monitored who were caring for patients in Texas. We still have the individuals who were contacts of the New York City patient being monitored in New York City. So we're not out of the woods, but the science is very clear that catching Ebola requires direct contact with someone who is ill. And from our decades of experience fighting Ebola in Africa, we have not seen any outbreaks. We've not seen any spread that is from contact with someone before they became ill. We have not seen spread from people to people who've not had that kind of direct contact. Just to recap, I want to thank everyone for joining us. We have new guidelines that are being posted today. They increase the level of protection of the health and safety of Americans, which is our first and foremost priority, while at the same time protecting those who are doing the heroic work of protecting us from Ebola as they fight it on the shores of Africa as well.
Thank you, Jennifer. This concludes our call today. For media on the call, we should be sending out these guidelines imminently to our media list through email and posting to our website. So you should be receiving those if you haven't already. If you have additional questions, call 404-639-3286. Thank you.
This concludes today's conference. Thank you for your attendance. You may disconnect at this time. I can